actually inviting him to be Mekayim this mitzvah of Yibam. Now, the next prophet says, so now, the next pasuk is important. Next pasuk is very important. Halach, you know, it's funny. There's a medrash that says that what's the purpose of the Megillah for us? We don't learn the laws of Tumah. We don't learn halacha from it. What's the purpose of the Megillah? The medrash says, the purpose of this Megillah is to teach us the reward of those people that are so kind to us. That Yosef's Gomel Chesed, I mentioned the very first week. Yosef's father did one little mitzvah in his whole life. He took 3 steps in honor of Hashem. He was zocher to have Rus and Mashiach. Okay? And Rus herself was Moshe Nefesh to take care of Naomi. And Mela, the Megillah teaches us the law, the Char for the Milas Chassad. But the truth is that the Medrash's first observation is not quite accurate in a literal sense, because there are many, many halachas that are learned out of Rus. And the next pasuk says, Boaz took 10 people from the elders of the city, and he told them to sit. In other words, he told Sponi Almoni to sit, and he told 10 elders to sit. And the Medrash tells us that the reason Boaz is giving these orders to sit is because Boaz was the head of the Sanhedrin, and no one is permitted to sit in his presence without his permission. Therefore, he's always telling everybody to sit, because nobody's going to sit. Why did he take 10 people? What is the purpose of taking 10 people? Why does he need a minion? Right, so the Gemara gives 2 reasons. The Gemara says, this is the source of the halakha. This is how we know it. This is the source of the halakha that the bracha, well, you don't really need 10 people to get married, but you need 10 people to recite the Sheva brachas under the chuppah. And also, you actually need 10 people every night of Sheva brachas. But this is the source that the Sheva brachas that are recited under the chuppah can only be recited in the presence of a minion. In other words, you can marry somebody in front of 2 witnesses, but you would not recite the Sheva brachas. This is the raya, Birchas Chasanam Ba'atzara, and you see a number of ramifications. For example, does the chasan count as part of the minyan? You see, he doesn't, because Boaz had to get 10 people besides himself. Another thing, what if it's your second marriage? You need a minyan. Do you recite Sheva Bracha? You do. This is Boaz's second marriage. Remember, Boaz's wife died. It's also, according to the Zohar at least, it's also Ruth's second marriage, because Ruth was married to Machlan. So again, we see that all these halakhas, we see that you need a minyan, and also you recite Sheva Bracha for all of these situations. Actually, the Machlokes, the Gemara has another pasuk, an alternative source for a minyan. And that source could imply that you count the chesed. So whether or not you count the chesed or not depends on what is regarded as the primary source. Since we don't know for sure, we try to have 10 people besides the chesed.
Do you need the Sheva Bracha to be a kosher wedding, right?
Well,
I mean, that's not part
when you say
of
a kosher wedding, the Kedushin is a valid Kedushin without saying Sheva Bracha. That's right. But it's a mitzvah, it says Sheva Bracha. So you're missing the mitzvah, if you don't have that.
Yeah,
you're missing the Bracha. Besides, the Bracha is a good, always a good thing to have. you try not to avoid that. So that's one reason. So one interpretation is that Boaz took 10 people because Boaz knew he's going to have a marriage, because either he's going to marry her, or if he's not going to marry her, the Goel is going to marry her. That's one reason. Another reason why the Gemara says there was a minyan is not because of Sheva Bracha, but Boaz wanted to publicly pronounce the halacha that female Moabites are permitted. And he wanted to do this publicly, and to do something publicly. The idea of a public is at least 10 people. And that's why Boaz wanted to be mefarsing. He wanted to publicize this halacha so that there'll be no more mistakes. Now we know, of course, unfortunately, even after Boaz married Ruth, in later generations, people still made the mistake. David HaMelech told life. People were saying, you're puzzled. You cannot marry into the Jewish people. Why people forgot the halakha is not entirely clear. One reason, as I mentioned, because Boaz died the day after he married Ruth, so many people figured that Boaz must have been wrong. Okay. Boaz is not wrong. Why Hashem caused this to happen all the time was, I mentioned, because part of David's lot in life was that everyone would think that David was to go through many, many tortures, many, many afflictions. People would look down upon him, people would oppress him, his own children will rebel against him. and this was to teach him sensitivity and compassion. Mm-hmm. And this was his role as Melech. You know, a king is not someone that's supposed to be better than the people. The king, rather, is supposed to be someone that feels for us, identifies with us. And that's why David had to go through all of these different things. So according to the first pshat, the 10 people here are for Sheva Brachas. According to the second pshat, the 10 people are to be Mefarsim, the halacha of Ammonis la'Ammonis. Which means to say that there's something missing in this pasuk. The pasuk doesn't say what he did with the 10 people. According to the pshat Migmar, he took the 10 people, and at that point, he told them the halacha with the approval of the Sanhedrin. The Malbim points out a very interesting point, that the sequence is very important here. Boaz announced the halacha, then he offered the option to the Goel. The point is that if Boaz would have first asked the Goel to marry Ruth, and the Goel would say no, and then Boaz would announce the halacha, there's really two things wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Number one, Boaz could be accused of deceiving the Goel because the Goel does not yet know the halacha officially if he wasn't a good Talmud Chacham. Secondly, people would think Boaz is maybe making up the halacha because it'll be for his benefit. He wants to marry Ruth. But if Boaz announces the halacha at a time when maybe the Goel is going to marry, this removes any suspicion that Boaz is doing this for his own selfish benefit. That's why Boaz first announced the halacha, and then he proposed this thing to the Goel.
He'd have to do that, because otherwise he'd be offering it to the person, and they would think that it was offered to do, and not related.
Yeah.
I mean, so if he didn't say, like, he's offering...
Well, that's the other thing. Right, that's the other thing. In other words, that's right. In other words, of course the Goel is refusing. What type of thing is that?
But what
are we refusing? All right, well, we'll see. It's Taka Akasha. Again, we say, Elaine Hayab Divrei Torah, he was mute in Divrei Torah. Actually, one could also say he was deaf in Divrei Torah. We'll see. There's some very interesting pshatim. If Boaz, in fact, was mefarshim the halacha before the Goel was asked, what was the Goel's problem? And we'll see. There's some very, very interesting explanations for that. Okay. Then Boaz says, all right, so now we have the 10 people, because either he knows it's going to be a chasna or he's mefarshim the halacha, and then Boaz offers the Goel the Redeemer. Now here's a very interesting puzzle. When Boaz first talks to the Redeemer, he doesn't mention the rest at all. He doesn't mention marriage. He talks about a field. He says, there's a field that belongs to our brother Elimelech. And actually the Midrash speaks out that our brother Elimelech, Boaz was not a brother of Elimelech, and Boaz is not a brother of Tov. Actually, Elimelech is a nephew. Boaz's father was a brother of these two. But a person very often calls his uncle his brother in Tanakh. So that's not so unusual. The reason is because a son is like a replacement of his father. Therefore, if Boaz's father was Elimelech and Tov's brother, then Boaz would consider himself a brother of them as well. He says, there is a field that belongs to our brother Elimelech that Naomi has sold. There's a mitzvah in the Torah we know that when somebody sells their field in Eretz Yisrael, there's a mitzvah on the relative to buy back the field, keep the field in the family. Therefore, although he doesn't mention it in the Torah, but the Chara he seems to be referring to the mitzvah in the Torah on a relative to buy back a field. Therefore, since you're the relative, you're the closest relative, I'd like you to have the privilege to buy back the field. See, what Boaz is doing is kind of a trap, because as a relative, the Goel has two responsibilities. One is to redeem the field, and one is to marry Ruth. If the Goel says, I am assuming my rights as the closest relative, Boaz then turns around and says, well, then marry Ruth. It's kind of a package deal. But let's take the thing about the field first. The pasuk seems to say that Naomi sold her field. Okay? And now you have a mitzvah to redeem it. Now, why would Naomi sell her field? If you remember, it says that Naomi came back to Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the harvest. And the portion today, because it's already the harvest season, she has a field that she can't plant. So what she did was, she sold her field to have money to live off. Apparently, although Ruth was gathering in the field, this is not enough for all living expenses, etc., etc. It wasn't enough for rent. I don't know exactly what other expenses they had. But Naomi was going to sell her field. This is how some of the fortune went. Now, there are two questions here. First of all, Naomi would not inherit the field. Women don't inherit their husbands. If a husband dies, if Elimelech dies, Naomi would not be the one that would get her field. Who would get her field? Boaz would have gotten the field, really. Boaz would be the closest survivor. Actually, Tov would have gotten the whole field. Because if a person dies and has no sons and no daughters, and the daughter-in-law doesn't count here, then it goes to his brother. The wife does not inherit them. The Torah does not, I don't know why, a wife does not inherit. Now, what does a wife get when a husband dies? What a wife gets when a husband dies may actually be better than inheritance. What a wife gets is, a wife gets the right to collect your pursuer, and the wife is also entitled to be supported until she gets married.
Who supports her?
Who supports her? The people that inherit the property. In other words, the husband has property. The husband, let's say you have sons, that's a simpler case. Here there were no sons, Malcolm and Chalion died, but if a man dies and has two sons and a wife, so the halacha is, the sons inherit all of the property, but they are obligated to support the wife, plus Tehu Ksuv, which is a fixed amount. Tehu Ksuv plus support the wife until she remarries. If she never remarries, she's supported forever. In addition, you have to let her live in the home that she occupies with her husband. And she has the right to stay. So it's not her home, it's their property in theory, but they have to let her live in that home. Okay? That's the woman's right.
So it would have to pay rent for it. The son?
Yeah, the son. That would be part of the support. Support is not just food. Support is food, clothing, rental, all that. Okay? And it has to be in the manner to which she was accustomed, right? That she lived elaborately. That's their chiyuv, is to support her elaborately. Okay? But inheritance per se, a woman does not have. So how would Naomi... So basically, in this case, let's think of something about the Seder of Jerusha, of inheritance. Elimelech dies. Elimelech's two sons are not alive anymore. So the Torah says, if you don't have sons, then it goes to your daughter. But you don't have a daughter here, and daughter-in-law don't count, because the daughter-in-law is just a wife. A wife cannot inherit from her husband, who's the son. Okay? So if you don't have sons, you don't have daughters, Jerusha goes over to your father. Elimelech's father was probably not alive, but certainly wasn't alive. This was Nachshon ben Aminadab, the head of the tribe of Yehuda. He died many years before. Actually, he died in the desert. So who are you left with? So you don't have sons, you don't have daughters, father's not alive, it goes to your brother. Well, the one brother that we know about that's still alive, Boaz's father's not alive, the one brother we know that's alive is this Tov. Mm-hmm. So Tov would own the field anyway. So he wouldn't have to redeem it. The field belongs to Tov.
How come he still owns it? No, Elimelech
left. Yeah, Elimelech did not sell his land. Uh-huh. That's right, Elimelech did not sell his land. Because, you know, they hoped to come back. Uh-huh. Although they were gone 10 years. Alright, so one halachic question is, how does Naomi own a field here? But that could be easily answered, because very often women were paid off their ketubah with land. In other words, basically, I owe my wife money in a ketubah. Right? So instead of paying her money, I would give her the field, and then this would become her field. So a woman does not acquire by inheritance, but a woman does acquire property through what she is given as payment of the ketubah. So we have to say that when Elimelech died, she is entitled to enforce her ketubah, so she can go to Basin, and Basin will give her a field. Okay, in other words, this is what Basin does. Basin is good, like anything else. Husband owes wife money. If husband doesn't have the money, wife can take his property. Okay? So, therefore, we have to learn, Lechora, that the reason Naomi has a field is this is in payment of her ketubah. And also, we find that Ruth also owns a field, and probably this is in payment of her ketubah from Machlon. Same thing, Machlon owns property. Because what happened? Elimelech died first. So Machlon inherited some property. And when Machlon dies, Ruth gets that property. That's why we have fields that are owned both by Ruth and by Naomi.
This happened once they came back. But they were better with
this thing. That's right. That's right. When they were away, the fields weren't there. But as soon as they got back, they were able to enforce their claim against the field.
The land is payment of the
field. Okay? Which means it's not the whole land that goes to them. It's only the amount of land that is equivalent to whatever the dollar, whatever the value of the approval was. Two can have different values because you're permitted to add more. There's a minimum, but very often people add higher figures. So that's the that's how they get property. But there's another question here. That the Torah says that when a field is sold, this is in Parsha B'chukos, the last Parsha in Vayikra. No, I'm sorry, it's in Bahar, which is the next to last Parsha in Vayikra. Torah says that when you sell a field to your friend, of course the sale is only valid until Yovel. You know that. Basically, you always get the field back by the 50th year. Today, there's no Yovel in Eretz Yisrael. The reason there's no Yovel in Eretz Yisrael at all is because Yovel doesn't depend on the Beit Hamikdash. It's not because of the Beit Hamikdash. You know, we see a lot of things are bustle because there's no temple, but nothing to do with that. Even during the time of the second Beit Hamikdash, there was no Yovel. So Yovel depends on most of the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael.
Why?
How do we know that?
Why?
Why? Well, because as the Torah says by Yovel.
There is
a difference between Shemitah and Yovel. Shemitah is every 7 years, right? Yovel is the 50th year. The 49th, the seventh Shemitah will be followed. We'll have a Shemitah and a Yovel, one after the other. The restrictions, a lot of the restrictions are the same. The prohibition against working the land is the same for Shemitah and Yovel. Yovel has some special things. Yovel, the slaves go free. This is never Canaan. Non-Jewish slaves go free. Yovel, land goes back to the original owner. You cannot sell land more than 50 years. And if it's 1 year before Yovel, it's only 1 year. Okay? That's special. Now, Yovel, the Gemara tells us, Yovel depends on these things. That's what we know this from. Yeah, it says, the Kidashta Mishnasa Hamishim Shami should sanctify the 50th year. The Kresam Jeror Ba'aret, and you should proclaim liberty. He's on the liberty dome. You should proclaim liberty in the land, l'chol yosheveha, to all its inhabitants. And the Gemara Darshan, that the reason it says you should proclaim liberty to all its inhabitants is that Yovel applies only if all of the inhabitants, all of the people that should be in Israel, are in Israel. Now, unlike, for example, Truma, unlike all the other mitzvot, which don't depend on all of the Jews being in Eretz Israel, but Yovel is the one mitzvah that does. And therefore, even during the Second Temple, when we had a Beit Hamikdash, did you know that most of the Jews did not live in Israel during the Second Temple? Most of the Jews were very happy in Goa. Only a small minority.
In Babel
and Persia. So therefore, they did not observe Yovel since the time of the first destruction of the Beit Hamikdash. Now, Shemitah, they did observe. There's an argument. Is this Bel Raisa? Is this under Torah law? Only rabbinic. But many people say Shemitah under Torah law is the same thing as Yovel. And they only observed it rabbinically. Why didn't they observe Yovel rabbinically? Because Tosfos says it would be too difficult for a Tzibur to have a Shemitah and a Yovel two consecutive years when they couldn't work. The rabbi did not impose on them the requirements of Yovel. That's why in Israel there's no remembrance of Yovel at all today.
Why is the majority of the people
Well, according to many opinions, you do, except the rabbis impose it anyway. In other words, under Torah law, you would need. In other words, under Shemitah in Israel today would not be Bel Raisa. Except the rabbi said, in order that we should remember the observance of Shemitah, the rabbi said we should do it anyway. Yovel, they didn't say, because to have a Yovel and a Shemitah would be too difficult for people not to work the land for 2 years. Yeah. Okay, so that's Yovel. So then it says, what about before Yovel? And as you sell your land, so Yovel, you're going to get it back. What about before Yovel? So there's a mitzvah on relative or on the person himself try to buy back the field. And in other words, what this means is the person who bought the field is obligated to resell it. And you are obligated to resell it if you're given the price that you paid. Not even the price that you paid. What you do is you deduct for the number of years. For example, let's assume I buy a field right after yoga for $50. Just a crazy number. That means I have bought 50 years of field for $50. That means I'm paying $1 a year. So if you, just say you're the original owner, if you want to buy it back for me after 20 years, I am obligated to resell it, but you don't have to come up with $50. You only have to come up with $30.
Wow.
See? Because I pay $50, but I already got $20 back from using it for 20 years. Therefore, you don't have to pay me for the amount of time that I've already used the field. You only have to pay me for the number of years that I haven't used the field. Okay? So you can get back the field. The mitzvah of ge'ula, the mitzvah of redemption, does not require that you pay back everything you receive, but it requires you pay back all the years that have not been enjoyed by the person giving up the field. Okay? So far this is very consistent. So this is exactly what's going on here. Naomi, we don't know how many years it was, the Yovo, etc., but Naomi sold the field. There's a mitzvah on the relative to buy back the field, and the purchaser must sell it back. Okay? So far everything's good. The problem is
the mitzvah on the purchaser to buy back?
No, that's the purchaser.
What's the mitzvah?
The mitzvah is either the person, the owner, has a mitzvah to buy it back, or the closest relative of the owner has a mitzvah to buy it back and give it back to the owner.
Why is she not considered the owner?
Who? Naomi is considered the owner, but she doesn't have the money. In other words,
but it's hers. Why should she have to buy it from anybody?
No, but she sold it.
Oh, okay.
The Pusik says, in other words, if Naomi, my first question was, how did Naomi own the field? And I explained because Naomi bought.
Right,
okay. But then the Pusik says, Naomi sold her field.
Uh-huh.
Now that she sold her field, she's going to get it back when it's Yovel, but it's not Yovel yet. So there's a mitzvah on either Naomi or the closest relative to buy back the field, to keep it in the family, and therefore Boaz is telling the Goel, buy it back, to redeem it. Okay, this is the mitzvah of redemption. Right? No. When Yovel comes, you don't have to redeem it. You get it back automatically. We're talking about redeeming it before Yovel comes.
So to do it as soon as possible.
Right. Right, you see that? In other words, if I sell a field and it's...
Why does she have to sell it first?
She had to sell it because she needed the money. She came back.
She
came back during harvest. Okay.
Yeah,
she came back. It was during the harvest. She didn't have time. Wasn't able to come. Okay. So she sold it because she needed the money. There's a mitzvah to keep fields
in
the family. If Naomi herself could not get the money to buy it back, there is a mitzvah on the closest relative. He's called the redeemer. He's called the goel. He redeems the field by bringing it back. Now, in truth, when Yovel comes, she's going to get it back anyway. But, you want to get it back as soon as possible. But there's one problem. And the problem is that when somebody buys a field, he must be allowed to keep it for at least 2 years. Which means a redeemer has no right to force a resale of the field until after 2 years. And if you buy a field, the Torah says, you are entitled to keep it for at least 2 years. Well, if you want it, you're willing to resell it, you could, but there's no mitzvah on you to do so. And there's no mitzvah on the goel to try to get it back. Now here, obviously, Naomi has not sold the field for 2 years. She came back after Pesach sometime. And now we're talking about 3 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to say that Naomi had actually sold the field, how could there be a mitzvah of ge'ula? There's no mitzvah of ge'ula. The problem is a halachic problem here, that there's no mitzvah of redemption until the purchaser has kept the field for 2 years. And we know this again from Bahar. It says that you must let the purchaser have two harvests. It means keep the field for 2 years, you can at least have two harvests. Again, the idea is you don't buy a field, it's not derech eretz really to buy a field and then lose it the next day. You want to have some security, some use. So you must have, the seller is obligated to give you 2 years of use. That's why many Mefarshim say that in order to understand what is this obligation of redeeming the field in accordance with the halacha, because again, we try to interpret all of this in accordance with the halacha, we have to say that when it says Naomi sold her field, it doesn't mean she actually sold, but it means she is planning. It means Naomi has not sold her field. But what we're saying is, Naomi is short of funds. During the harvest season, everything was okay because Ruth was gleaning after Boaz's field. But now the harvest is over. Naomi has no funds. So she's going to sell her field.
So why would they write it? She sold.
So we're saying it like this. I didn't hear you.
Why would they write it?
No,
sold it.
Here's the idea, because very often in Tanakh, if something is a certainty to happen, you are for sure going to do something, we can actually talk about it as if it already happened. It's so certain.
But we always know that, doesn't it?
Well,
you know, as soon as you say such and such is definitely going to happen, it doesn't happen.
Well, in fact, it didn't happen yet.
I mean, yeah.
But remember, what Boaz is trying to do, Boaz is trying to tell the Goel, you must ask. You must ask, because otherwise it's so certain that she's going
to
sell it. Do you understand? So we're not. So what this means is like this. We're technically not talking about the mitzvah of redeeming a field that is already sold. But rather we're saying, just as there is a mitzvah to redeem a field that's already sold to be sure it stays in the family, so there's certainly a mitzvah to give Naomi, to buy the field from Naomi to ensure that she doesn't sell it and take it out of the family. In other words, this is a preventative ge'ula. This is not pure redemption. This is a preventative redemption. In other words, give Naomi the money she needs so that the field will stay with us in the Shevet, in the tribe, so that there'll be no need to sell it out. Okay? So, of course, there's no two-year limit. If Naomi didn't sell the field yet, you can prevent the sale right now. Because if Naomi had sold the field, the kasha it would have been, there wouldn't have been redemption for another 2 years. Okay? So that's how many Mephorshim learn Machra Naomi. Okay. So that's the first part of the proposal. So he tells the Goel, listen, you can see Boaz's strategy. He wants the Goel to look at himself as the closest member of the family. Listen, we have a field here. There's a mitzvah that the closest relative should redeem the field, and in this case, prevent it from being sold. Do you consider yourself the closest relative? He says, sure, I'm the closest relative. Aha, you're the closest relative, huh? You're closer than me. Well, we also have Ruth. There's a mitzvah on the closest relative to marry Ruth. Are you going to say you're not the closest relative? He just said you were. He says, if he first mentions the field, in order that the Goel should assert that he is the closest one. And then he says, what about Ruth?
Yeah, but Boaz wanted to marry. Why would he portray it in such a way to make it more?
Well, again, it could be that Boaz Badafka wants to show that Boaz... remember, Boaz was mefarsim b'halacha, that is seen al Moabite as Mutra, and it's very important that people don't suspect that Boaz didn't get the Goel a fair chance. So therefore, he's really bending over backwards to try to convince the Goel to do it. And this is what he says, that, of course, on the other hand, it's very interesting.
Yeah,
some of Fortune say the other way. Because some of Fortune say that he refers to Ruth the Moabite. When he finally talks about Ruth, he calls her Ruth the Moabite. And the reason he calls her Ruth the Moabite is because he wants to make the idea of marrying Ruth displaceable. The Goa. Maybe this indicates that Boaz was in a certain hesitancy, trying to be objective, but on the other hand, he's very much open. That the Goel doesn't do it. That's why he called her Hamoavia. Reminds the Goel, yes, there's something real bad about marrying all that. It's interesting, though, that Boaz already knew. Boaz seems to have a foreshadowing that the Goel wouldn't want to marry Ruth. Because when he's still talking about the field, he didn't talk about Ruth, he was just talking about the field. He said, I wanted to say that you should buy this field in front of the basin. Okay? And if you don't want to buy it, tell me, and I will know. Because I'm the next one. So the Medrash says, why does Boaz use the lashon, tell me and I will know? because the Medrash says that the Lashon I will know, this is a remnant to marriage. Because when it says Adam, when Adam and Eve lived together, it talks about Adam knew his wife. Marriage, the relationship of marriage is called Yudia. So Boaz is like saying, Boaz is like getting ahead of the story on it. He didn't mention risk yet. He says to go, if you want to buy the field, buy it. If you don't want to buy the field, tell me that I will be able to know. So the Medrash says it doesn't mean I will know that you don't want to buy the field. You have to push it, obviously. But he's been Meramed, although the Gaul may not have understood this, probably didn't. But Boaz is saying that I will be able to marry you. That's the lesson of the Ada. Okay. So the Goel, not knowing that Boaz was talking about Ruth, says, I'll gladly to do it. I always like having another deal. And then Boaz says, but there's a catch involved. If you are the closest relative, there's also a mitzvah to perpetuate the memory of the dead by marrying Ruth. And here he mentions Ruth the Moabite, which I said, according to some of the questions, is designed to discourage the Goel. Although Boaz was mafarshim from the halacha. So we'll see. For a variety of reasons, the Goel was still afraid. He says you have to marry Ruth to perpetuate the Moabites cannot marry into the Jewish people, yeah, because they didn't give you food and water, and basically the Avera was ingratitude because Abraham took care of Lot, etc. So females, we say, a female, there's no time that a female didn't give you food and water because it's not the derech of a woman to go out and go to a strange army and feed them. Okay? So that's one way of looking at it. So one way of looking at it is this is a logical interpretation of a pasuk. But this is the Sanhedrin interpreting a pasuk. Another way of looking at it is this was a halacha that was transmitted all the way from Moshe. It wasn't that the Rabbanan looked at the pasuk and they interpreted it, but this was a direct tradition all the way down. Now, what's the difference? The difference is like this. If the Rabbanan interpret a pasuk a certain way, the Rambam says a later Sanhedrin is free to say that they were wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, we can't say that they were wrong. We're talking about a Sanhedrin. A Sanhedrin, 71, can say that the decision of an earlier Sanhedrin was a mistake. On the other hand, if you're talking about a halakha that was given to Moshe B'Sinai, that can never be mistaken. So the Goel is saying things like this. I know you, Boaz, you're the head of the Sanhedrin, and you just said I'm allowed to marry Ruth. I accept that. And I know if I marry Ruth, I'm not committing an avera, because I am acting in accordance with the decision of a Sanhedrin of 71. But what if 200 years later another Sanhedrin decides that your interpretation was wrong? So I'm okay, but then my kids are going to be messed up because retroactively they've come from a woman that is the stigma of Moabite. So that's why he tells Goa, he says, Boaz, you Boaz, you're so sure your decision is right, so you marry her because you know you're right. I don't know you're right. I know that you're right now, so that's why he's not concerned about his sin, because about it, it's a davar pasha, that if you act in accordance with the decision of your Sanhedrin, even if a later Sanhedrin says they were wrong, you have not committed an avera. But what he's saying is, my children are going to be pasha, because 200 years later, who knows what's going to happen. But, well, people can, yeah. But the answer is that this couldn't happen, because Boaz was really giving over halacha that was given to Moshe the Sinai, which can never be changed. So that's how the Brisker interprets what the Goel is saying here. So the Goel's mistake was not that he thought the halacha was that she was prohibited. He knew the halacha was just announced that she was permitted, but he didn't realize this was a tradition that was given all the way from Moshe. Why didn't Boaz argue with him further?
But why is this a point? Is this not something that you're interpreting? Is this from the
well,
humanity? From
that's Moshe? Already, that's getting the center. That's already the idea of Elam Hayyad Gibber Torah, which means to say, this person is not a learned person. You tell him you can marry Ruth, and he'll understand that. When you're talking about how do you know and what's the source.
No, you just said it was from Moshe. So
well,
just simply
yeah.
Said it like that, and he would have.
Well, maybe Boaz didn't want to go into all that explanation. Boaz didn't want to make it too attractive
to
the person. In other words, once the person, he felt it was necessary that he tell the person the halakha that this is okay, but he didn't want to adopt it. The person said he didn't want to do it because he made a mistake. Boaz was not going to correct that mistake. But Boaz very much wanted to do it himself. Why did he want to do it himself? Well, it was seen with Ruach HaKodesh that from Ruach would come Mashiach. Yeah. And you see too, after all, how come when Naomi, they all seem to have known this, how come Naomi sends Ruth to Boaz and Tov is the closest relative? Send him to Tov. So apparently, you have to give the Goel a chance, but it was understood that Boaz is really the one from whom the Malchus takes others should come. Okay? That seems to be the understanding. Not much in Ruach HaKodesh. That's what this Goel does. Okay. That's what the goal refuses. So then there's a transition, there's kind of a digression in the pasuk. The pasuk says there was an old tradition in Israel among the Jewish people, an old tradition, on Geula, on redemption, and on Tamura, and on substitution. That means barter. That people would always take off their shoes. Which means to say, this is a barter. If I wanted to sell you something, let's say, for example, I want to sell you a house. And you don't have the money to pay me. Okay? So, it used to be that you'd be able to own the house by giving me an item of value. You give me a shoe. Actually, not just a shoe. Anything called barter. Anything of value you give me, even if it's worth a penny, will be enough to enable you to now own the house. But you still have to pay me. You still have to pay me. The house is now yours. This is called chalitza, exchange. I give you something, and the thing that you want to give me, it could be an elephant, it could be a car, it could be a piece of property, now belongs to me.
What could you do?
Chalitza. Which means exchange.
With a collateral.
Collateral is different. There's collateral too. That's mashka.
Oh, okay.
This is not mashka. This is just exchange. Barter. Right? Today we do it, use a handkerchief. But in Boaz's time, they used to use a shoe. Now it mentions, this was an old tradition, Geula and Tamura. We have two phrases here. We have redemption, and that means buying something. Geula is redeeming it just to buy something. And Tamura is bartering, and you exchange two things. Scott Mareve wrote a very famous book where he explains his anti-state of Israel philosophy. He called it, in a very pun of words, Al Hagula on the redemption, the Al Hatmura on the substitute. The Tmura means substitution. It means to say that what people say is the Geula is really the Tmura. The home of the Israel is the Tmura. But there is an argument in the Gemara, and actually there's a Medrash applies to such. The Medrash says that those within the Israel, allegorically, it gives a pshat, which has nothing to do with the context here, but those within the Israel used to be among the Jewish people, they would praise Hashem on Geula, on redemption. They would say, Zek Haley Vandeo, this is from the Song of the Red Sea, this is my God, and I will glorify him. But then, just 40 days later, no, not 40 days, yeah, 3 months, and then 40 days later, with the Chedor Ego, Allah Tzmura, they substituted God for other things. They substituted God for a golden calf. That is the Tamura substitution. Okay. And the Medrash says, a very interesting thing, the Medrash says originally, when people used to sell fields, the way they would transfer ownership is by one person giving his shoe to the other person. It's not chalitza. We're not talking about marriage. We're talking about selling a field.
Oh.
If I'd want to sell you a field, we would do it. We would transfer ownership. And you still have to pay money, but you transfer ownership by removing the shoe. Who would remove the shoe? We would say the purchaser. I want to buy a field. The purchaser would give his shoe to the seller, and this would give him ownership of the field. Barter. I give you the shoe. I get the field. Okay. It says, however, that the custom of the shoe fell into disuse, and they began to sell their fields another way. They would take a barrel of figs, they would smash the barrel. Whenever a person would sell a field, a lot of the kids would get around and say, this man is smashing his inheritance. They would kind of insult the person. You're getting rid of the field, you're selling your inheritance. And they would do it this way. Boaz reinstituted, at this point, Boaz reinstituted the use of the shoe. Now, why is this important? And exactly what does the shoe serve here? Now, again, don't be confused. Boaz removed his shoe and he gave it to the goer. This is not chalitza. This is not chalitza for a number of reasons. First of all, chalitza, the guy that loses his shoe is the guy that doesn't want to marry. Here, Boaz removes the shoe. Not so. Boaz wants to marry. This isn't chalitza. Second of all, in chalitza, the one who removes the shoe is the woman. The woman removes the shoe from the man. Here, Boaz is taking off his shoe and giving it to the goa. Okay? You see, it's not chalitza. Third of all, the only time you do chalitza is if none of the brothers, none of the relatives want to marry her. Here, Boaz wants to marry her. Why would they do chalitza? Okay? So this is not chalitza. What this is just barter. How is this chalitza? Why is this barter? The goel, as the closest relative, has two rights, according to Halacha. He has a right to marry Ruth if he wants, and he has a right to redeem the field if he wants. The goel is giving away his right to Boaz. Right. He's giving away both of his rights to Boaz. How does Boaz acquire rights? He acquires rights by barter. Okay? So this is not chalitza. He is acquiring the goel's rights by giving the goel a shoe. Okay? And this is, again, this is a very important halakha. This is really king and chalitza. The way you acquire rights is by giving something for them. Okay?
Why didn't you give a shoe? Because Boaz had money. Why didn't you give a shoe?
Well, okay, now, what was the idea of a shoe generally? How come the Medrash goes to a point? Because originally they used to do it with a shoe, then they went to this breaking the barrel, and then they went back to shoe. What's the idea of a shoe? Why is that important here? Well, to some extent, giving a shoe is a sign of a free man. In fact, when the brothers sold Yosef, the Medrash says they took the money and they bought shoes for Yosef. And the reason is they felt they were finally free. Yosef was like, Lord, they felt free. Shoe is a kind of freedom. So when I commit myself to you, when I promise to pay you money or something like that, and you give me something, I give you my shoes, I give you my freedom. I pledge that I will do what you want if you, in other words, I pledge, I give you my freedom if you give me your right. Okay, it's kind of my commitment to you. But another thing too, is that in Kabbalah, the shoe represents the body, because the body is called the shoe of the soul. Okay? So, one of the portions of the Medrash says like this. Originally, when the Jews were in a high madrega when they came to Eretz Israel, they did all of their business for Shem Shemayim. They did all of their business for spiritual concern. They didn't sell fields to make money. They sold fields, whatever they needed, are not supposed to be able to serve Hashem properly. So this was signified by the fact that whenever they engaged in a business transaction, they would remove their shoes. As if to say, I am not doing this for the good, I am doing this for the neshama. When the Jews got into a lower madrega, they adopted a different ceremony because it no longer reflected what they were doing. They were doing business for money. But Boaz, who is agreeing to marry Ruth, totally l'shem shemayim, Boaz has now reintroduced the idea of removing his shoe to show that his kavanah is totally l'shem shemayim. It is not for the guf, but it is for the neshama. Okay? And this is the idea. But what we see is we see a number of halakhos here. We see the idea of king and chalipin. I mentioned last week that at a chasna, this is why the chasna and the kala have to accept the handkerchief. You go to the chasna. The chasna takes the handkerchief from the witness. When he receives the handkerchief, he becomes obligated to fulfill the tefillah. If he's receiving something, just like he's receiving the shoe, he's chayav to do his obligation. Then you give a handkerchief to the caliph. When she receives the handkerchief, this obligates her to do her obligation. Okay? The only question you can ask is that l'chora, what it should be done is that the groom should give her his handkerchief, because basically that's Boaz. Mm-hmm. The guy that's on the receiving end is the one that gives. So the caliph gives the chasan her handkerchief, and that obligates him towards her, and the chasan should give the caliph his handkerchief, and that obligates her towards him. But the truth is that the witnesses, who are the ones that give the handkerchief, are acting on behalf of the chasan or the caliph. Therefore, when they give you their handkerchief, it's as if they're giving you the handkerchief belonging to the other person. They're considered messengers, shluchim. All right, so that's that. Okay. So what we have here, what we've had here is. Okay. So again, just to review what happened over here. Boaz assembles this minion. He offers the Goel the right to exercise his right as closest relative. Goel refuses. Boaz is not content just to take the Goel's word. Boaz wants the Goel, as it were, to actually sell him his right to barter, because this finalizes. The thing is like this: until you have this type of barter, you can always change your mind. The Goel says, "I don't want to do it." But 5 minutes later, the Goel could say, "I want to do it." But once the Goel has, as it were, sold Boaz's right, because Boaz had given him the shoe, this now becomes Boaz's property. Once it becomes Boaz's property, the Goel can no longer change his mind. It makes it irrevocable. Okay? That's the idea of kinyan, acquisition. Boaz did an act of acquisition to acquire the Goel's two rights to buy the field and to marry you. Okay. Alright. So then the rest of the parak goes on and says people were giving various brachos. But all the people that were there at the wedding, we have a consonant, right? We have 10 people. So everybody says...
Was this present?
Yeah.
Was present for
all the folks? It's an interesting point. It doesn't say Riff was present, but Riff must have been present. Because if we interpret that the 10 people, if we interpret that the 10 people were there for a chasana, Boaz married Riff, right? That's very good.
Is that all that's going on?
Unless she came sometime, unless maybe they brought her after Boaz took off his shoe and acquired the right. I don't know. Well, that could be. And they gave her a bracha. They said, Hashem should bless this woman that is coming into your house. She should be like Rachel and Leah, from whom the Jewish people were rebuilt. So we see what? Rachel, why is this? Well, first of all, why Rachel and Leah? Why not Sarah and Rivka? Well, first of all, it's important that Rachel and Leah, really all the Imams, they came from non-religious families. I mean, they came from families that worshipped the Avodah Zarah. Okay? So, what they're saying in this bracha is that in spite of their origin, they were zocher to build the Jewish people, those two roots should have that same capacity. And why do they compare to Rachel and Leah, not Sarah and Rivka? Because Sarah and Rivka each had one dad son. Right? Sarah had a Yishmael, although Yishmael did the tshuva at the end of his life, and Rivka had an Esau. But Rachel and Leah were zochos, they were merited, that all of their children were tzaddikim. All of their children founded the Jewish people, therefore we're giving Ruth the same bracha, she should be like Rachel and Leah.
They're
not the Jewish people. I mean, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Abraham, "Ki bi Yitzchak yikarei l'chazara," that your seed, your people, the people that you were destined to find, will be from Yitzchak. Uh-huh. Yishmael was
the
tshuva. Yishmael kept the end of his life, kept the Zion Yitzchak, the seven sons of Noah, and he was righteous, a righteous non-Jew, but he was not Jewish. The only additional mitzvah that Yishmael had was Brit Mila. The Muslims are obligated at the age of 13. Right. Alright. So that's why it says Rachel and Leah, not Sarah and Rivka. But the other question is, why does it mention Rachel before Leah? Yaakov married Leah first.
He preferred Rachel.
Right. So one pshat the Medrash says, very simply, is that since Rachel was Yaakov's favorite wife, she is the Atzeres HaBayis, she is the foundation of the house, she is the one he wants to marry first, so we're giving Rivka bracha that she should have that characteristic. If you remember, too, there is the Seder Hadaros, Sefer that says that Ruth was the reincarnation of Rachel, and Naomi was the reincarnation of Leah. Ruth's neshama is the neshama of Rachel. And that's why Mashiach comes from Rachel, because although Mashiach comes from Yehuda, okay, you may ask the question, why should Mashiach come from Yehuda? Yehuda comes from Leah, Yaakov's favorite wife is Rachel. The answer is that Mashiach comes from the union of Boaz, that comes from Yehuda, who comes from Leah, with Ruth, that has the neshama of Rachel. So it's really a union of Rachel and Leah, and it says Rachel first because Ruth's essence is really the essence of Rachel. There's another thing the Medrash says, very interestingly. It says that although most of, except for two children, all of these 10 children came from Leah or from the other wife, but all of the children are considered Rachel's children. That's why we say that Rachel Mavacha Alpanera, Rachel cries on her children. All of the children, all of the Pai are called Rachel's children. Why was she married? Why did she marry to have all the children considered her children? The reason is because since people spoke bad about Rachel, they degraded her. Kadosh Baruch Hu gave her this curse that all of Pai Yisrael are considered her children. But when did they speak bad about her? When Rachel and Leah were still in Lavan's house, people used to say that Lavan has two daughters, the older and the younger. The older, Leah, will go to Yaakov, and will go to Esau. It's just the character said that Yaakov loves Rachel. Well, Yaakov and Esau were twins. Okay. So they say Yaakov and Esau were twins. They said the older will go to Yaakov and the younger will go to Esau. People used to say that Rachel will go to Esau. In fact, if you remember, when Leah is first described, it talks about Leah's eyes were soft and crying. Why was she always crying? Because after she discovered that Yaakov loved Rachel more, then Leah thought she would go to Esau. In other words, it was known that these two sisters will be split up to Yaakov and Esau. Mm-hmm. But until Yaakov showed that he loved Rachel, people used to say that Rachel will go to Esau. Okay? So Rachel suffered a lot from that. Another pshat is that people used to say Lashmara on Rachel, because since they saw Rachel didn't have children, they said Yaakov just took it for his nuts. After the people to Tashmish, which was a derech for the Dor HaMavos. Remember, the Dor HaMavos used to have two wives. One wife, they had the children. The other wife, they would not allow to become pregnant. So they just wanted to be But at the end, you know, but all those years that she didn't have children. So it says, because of the embarrassment that she suffered, all of the children of Kali Israel were zeichah to be considered the children of Rachel. Okay. Alright, a few more things. Let me just say one final voice. A few other things here. This is a voice from the B'nai Yisrael, a great Peter Chiedi. He says that it's a little complicated. It's interesting to match it. We were discussing why do you read Ruth on Shavuot. Okay? Well, one reason he gives it like this. That we read in Parshas Yisrael about the giving of the Ten Commandments, and that's really the written law, the Torah Shabbat, and gave us the written Torah. But you see from Ruth the importance of Torah Shabbat Ten. Because the whole permissibility of Ruth to marry the Jewish people depended on the rabbinic interpretation of Moabi's law. We've heard of him say specifically a female is an interest. This is what the Rabbanim darshan by interpreting a pasuk. Or at least it's a halacha, an oral halacha that was transmitted from Moshe to Sinai. In other words, it's outside of the written Torah. So what Ruth does is Ruth connects Torah Shabbat Ten is Torah Shabbat. And we read on Shavuot to show that we're accepting not just the Torah Shabbat, but also the Torah Shabbat. That's what we're speaking of. Now, we said that this is a very complicated thing. Let's take the gematria of one of Hashem's names, the Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. The gematria of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud is the Aleph is 1, the Dalet is 4, that's 5, the Nun is 55, and the Yud is 65. The gematria of the Shem Admet, Hashem's mastery over the world, is 65. Now, in gematria, there's also something called the gematria of Milud, the full gematria. We usually don't do full gematria. We usually do truncated gematria. What's a full gematria? A full gematria is, when you take Aleph, instead of counting Aleph as 1, you spell out Aleph. How would you spell Aleph? Aleph, Lamed, Fay. So the full gematria of Aleph is not 1. The full gematria of Aleph is 111. You see that? Okay. So, let's spell the full gematria of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. You have Aleph, it's Aleph Lamed Pei. That gives you 80 and 30 is 110, and 1 is 111. Aleph Dalet is Dalet Lamed Saf. It's spelled like Dela. That's 434. Okay. No, actually, I think it's spelled Dalet. It's the Dalet Lamed Dalet. That's 38. Okay, 38. Then you have Nun, is Nun Vav Nun. That's Nun, right? That gives you 106. And Yud is Yud Vav Dalet, which is 20. Yud Vav Dalet is 20. Okay. Now, if you take away... Alright, so that's your total... That's your full gematria, okay? Now, if you take away your open gematria, in other words, that's the Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, you'll have what we call the Nista, the hidden gematria. In other words, right, you have a full gematria, and then you take away the actual letters, first letters themselves, and you have what we call the Nista, the hidden gematria. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the regular gematria is Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, that's what? 65. Is that right? Yeah, 65. Now, the Nista, the hidden gematria, 80 and 30 is 110, 34, 56, 10, 16, 16, 16, 16, 16, 16, 16, 16, 16. Well, what he says in the Kenneth, he says like it, he says the gematria of Ruth, what is the numerical equivalent of Ruth? Ruth is 606. Uh-huh. 606 is the same gematria as the hidden gematria of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. That is, if you take away, if you take the full gematria of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud and you take away the first letter, the hidden gematria will be 606. Now, what is the significance of that? It says, Torah Shebal Peh is the hidden meaning of Torah. Torah Shebichsav is the open and obvious meaning. The oral law is the hidden meaning. And one who truly serves God through the hidden meaning of Torah, and not through the open meaning of Torah. Rus, the whole entry into Klal Yisrael, was through the hidden meaning of Torah. In her very name, it contains the hidden essence of serving Hashem. The gematria of Rus is the hidden gematria of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud of serving Hashem. Because it represents Torah Shebal Peh is hidden and not apparent on its surface. This is what he says. Simpler reason why Ruth adds up to 676 is because Ruth, as a non-Jew, already had to observe the seven commandments. So when she became Jewish, she added onto herself 606 additional commandments. That's why Ruth says that. Really, because the Ruth represents the Nistar, the hidden, concealed part of Torah. Good choice about that. I just set a number.
It worked out at the 400.
It worked out if it was 400, my first way I did it?
Could you use 400 minus 4 would be.
Let me just see. You have 110 here, and 430 here, and 66 here, and 10 here. That's 6, 4, and 11, 11 minus 12. And that's 626.
Okay.
Aleph, I take away these four letters.
I think these numbers might be wrong, because if you add 400 to this number, minus the four of the dollars, then you would get...
Let me just add these two letters, one thing. 80 and 30 is 110. Lamed and Kuf is 430, right? And then Vav and Nun.
Isn't
that right?
Because... No, you got it wrong. Because 1 is 3, 4, 5 is 9, and 1 is
10. Oh, 6. 6, 4, 9. Oh, 10. Ah, very good. Mm-hmm. Six, okay. Very good. Okay. Yeah, it's really amazing how people think of these things.
Do you remember the whole story of, I think it's called, like, Dad is the Red, where the Greek dream actually came, okay? And he said, I'm going to write down the quote. He said, it was special care because Dad was married a Muslim because he was a maidservant. Okay, so as a maidservant, he was considered half Jewish. In other words, So, therefore, she became committed to him.
Yeah.
As a result, when he died, the reason why, you wonder, well, how could